But let's find out what was going on during the Enlightenment. Let's start with Darren McMahon, who is a professor of history at Florida State and has got a couple of books out. One's about the Enlightenment, but he also has a nice big book out at the moment on happiness. But I asked Darren what he wanted to start with, and he's given it the title, Does the Enlightenment Need an Upgrade? So, Darren McMahon.
Good morning. Gosh, what a pleasure to be here. You know, there are times when you start to feel good about yourself, and then you open a program up like today's, and you start looking at the people on the list, and I thought, my God, I'm 42 years old, and I have yet to be the director of the Max Planck Institute. What am I doing? So this will be a spur. A couple of the token humanists were walking over to the building this morning, and a young woman came up and said, beyond belief? Not beyond hope, but beyond belief. Well, Roger left this very open-ended. He asked that, I do two things, essentially. He said, you know, it would be a good idea to be funny, and presumably not unintentionally so. And then he said, would you throw a bomb? And I thought about that for a little while, and I basically admitted to myself that I'm not really a bomb-throwing type of thinker. I'm not comfortable throwing rocks or using incendiary devices. But that I didn't really need to, because this morning I wanted to talk about the Enlightenment, what we might call Enlightenment 1.0, and that the Enlightenment can usually be counted upon to generate fireworks and explosions. I'm reminded of that first Macintosh operating system. Some of you remember that when there was a system failure, a little bomb came up with a burning fuse and says that, sorry, a system error has occurred. And I guess that my job here today is to talk a little bit as a historian, along with Professor Jacob, about what Enlightenment 1.0 was and whether it does need an upgrade, whether the bomb that tends to appear on the screen is internal to the system or external, the result of error or something else. Well, what exactly the Enlightenment was is, as I'm sure you're all aware, an old question. It's at least as old as 1784, when Immanuel Kant posed his famous question in the Berlinische Monatschrift, Was ist Aufklärung? But I would argue, in fact, it long precedes it, and it certainly goes well after. Both proponents and opponents of the movement have been asking the question, what is this thing, for a long, long time? And I think that's only fitting in that whatever else the Enlightenment may have been, it was certainly bound up with the art of posing questions. Emma Rothschild's reminds us that the Enlightenment was a, quote, discursive, disputatious, theorizing way of life, and that's something of a scholarly mouthful, but I think it gets it right. The Enlightenment was more concerned, really, with asking pointed questions than with providing hard and fast answers, although it certainly didn't shy away from providing answers when it needed to. Enlightenment relished, in other words, discussion. It relished questioning. It relishes getting into arguments, and it's done so from the very beginning. Some might say that the Enlightenment relished throwing bombs. And so I just want to talk about some of the explosions it has set off or been said to set off by way of bringing this up to the present. And I want to start by reading to you a passage from a French priest, a man by the name of Charles-Louis Richard, who was writing at the end of the old regime in the 1780s, about 5 years before the outbreak of the French Revolution, in a work he entitled The Exposition de la Doctrine des Philosophes Modernes, the exposition of the modern philosophers. It's a work about what we would call the Enlightenment. And here's what he says. Everywhere philosophy, modern philosophy, and he's referring to people like Diderot and D'Alembert and Voltaire, everywhere philosophy lights the torch of discord and of war, prepares poisons, sharpens swords, lays fires, orders murder, massacre, and carnage, sacrifices fathers by the hands of sons and sons by the hands of fathers, It directs lances and swords at the heads and the breasts of sovereigns, placing them on scaffolds, which it yearns to see flowing with sovereign's blood, blood that it will drink in deep draughts as it feasts its eyes on the horrible specter of their torn, mutilated, and bloody members. Now, in Richard's view, and Professor Jacob and I could cite to you a great many passages just like this from across Europe and indeed from the New World in just this vein. In Richard's view, the long fuse of the Enlightenment was preparing devastation of precisely this sort. The overturning of altars, regicide, parricide, social anarchy and breakdown, sexual license and dissolution, terror and civil war, followed by despotism and tyranny of a sort never before seen. And while you might be inclined to dismiss this rhetoric as so much nonsense and paranoid rant, and of course, on some level, that's precisely what it was, you also have to keep in mind, nonetheless, that all the things that Richard and his brethren imagined in their frenzied apocalyptic nightmares in the 50 or so years before 1789 actually came to pass. In the upheaval of the French Revolution and the subsequent wars, kings were killed, the church was destroyed, or at least the revolutionaries attempted to do so, altars were pillaged, sons were turned against fathers and fathers against sons, the patriarchal, hierarchical order of society was challenged, Jews and Protestants and atheists were allowed to vote and write alongside good Christian men and women, France was subsumed by civil war, and Europe was drowned in rivers of blood, that culminated in the great dictatorship of Napoleon. Now, this was not, to be sure, as Richard and others would later allege, because of a formal conspiracy or plot, and Timothy Dwight, then president of Yale College, delivers a sermon to the undergraduates in 1797, warning them that the plot that had led to the French Revolution was at foot in the United States, and we must fight the Enlightenment here before it lead to similar outcomes. Clearly, this was not a plot, and yet the terrible destruction of the French Revolution and the subsequent European-wide wars happened all the same, and that fact gave the likes of Richard a certain real credibility in the aftermath of the terror. Had they not predicted the apocalypse, had they not warned that the Enlightenment led to chaos and destruction, that the Enlightenment was a bomb? Well, that claim, however reductive and however stilted, carried considerable rhetorical force. And so it really shouldn't surprise us that it stayed around for an awful long time, finding its way into the thought of far more subtle thinkers than Richard, people of the stamp of Burke, even Tocqueville, and Taine in the 19th century and then thereafter for some time. It's revealing and also somewhat amusing that the very first definition of the Enlightenment as a movement and a period, and people don't refer to the Enlightenment as a time in Western history really until the end of the 19th century, at least in English and German. Hegel's doing it at the beginning of the 19th. The first definition in the Oxford English Dictionary appears in 1891, and it's a negative one. Here it is, Enlightenment, noun, sometimes used after the German Aufklärung or Aufklärerei, to designate the spirit and aims of the French philosophers of the 18th century, or of others whom it is intended to associate with them, in the implied charge, and this is the good part, of shallow and pretentious intellectualism, unreasonable contempt for tradition and authority, etc. If you go online and you look at the third edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, that definition's still up, which is very amusing and I think also telling. Because so powerful was this received set of associations between enlightenment on the one hand, and abstract theory, social license, atheism, and revolutionary despotism on the other, that it shows up even in the writings and thinking of those inclined to see the century of lights with a good deal of sympathy. Take Sir Isaiah Berlin, for example, a great defender of liberty and someone who could look upon the Enlightenment era as, quote, one of the best and most hopeful episodes in the life of mankind. And yet Berlin nonetheless can comment that, quote, the great 18th century philosophers, by whom he means primarily French philosophers, were ultimately responsible for a lot of intellectual tyranny ending in the Soviet Union in the Gulag. I have a graduate student right now who's doing a dissertation on how the Enlightenment gets swept up and historicized during the debates of the Cold War in the 1940s and 1950s, and it's clear that it's joined almost immediately to the critique and analysis of totalitarianism that people like Karl Popper and Hannah Arendt and Jacob Talman and others are working out in the 40s and 50s. And you get the further kind of confirmation or further assertion of the view that the Enlightenment lay not only behind the alleged tyranny of reason that was the French Revolution, but also behind the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. It is, as I say, really quite a common charge. And of course, it wasn't just those who took a dim view of the French or Russian revolutions who were inclined to malign the Enlightenment, but those on the self-conscious left as well. For doctrinaire Marxists, the Enlightenment was, predictably enough, simply ideological cover for the hegemony of the bourgeoisie. And for Marxists of the Western variety, the kinder, softer folks like Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno, the Enlightenment lay behind fascism and the Shoah, the infamous, perverse, and in my view ultimately rather silly argument of their dialectic of the Enlightenment of 1944, which begins with Odysseus and the Greeks and ends with disaster triumphant. Enlightenment is apparently the better part of Western civilization, and Enlightenment, we are told in a famous line, behaves towards things as a dictator toward men. The Enlightenment is totalitarian. The movement that aimed at liberating men and women from fear and establishing their sovereignty, at disenchanting the world, instead objectified nature and ended and enslaved humanity in a modern myth of the hegemony of reason. Now, it's true that a little bit like Foucault in this regard, who was so critical of the Enlightenment and at the same time attracted to it and by it, Adorno and Horkheimer had planned to write a sequel to the Dialectic of Enlightenment entitled Die Rettung der Aufklärung, or the Rescue of the Enlightenment, but they unfortunately never got around to it, and that reminds me a little bit of Innocent III's infamous Contemptus Mundi from the early 13th century, The Misery of the Human Condition, in which he, you know, chronicles how awful we all are. Alive we bring forth lice and tapeworms, and dead we beget worms and flies and dung and stench, and goes on in that vein. Innocent too had planned to follow the work with another that, quote, exalted man, but he never got around to it, and I think the order of the undertaking is telling. It's also telling that many of these same charges, that the Enlightenment was totalitarian, intolerant, responsible for the greatest ills of modernity, was responsible for imperialism, racism, misogyny, environmental destruction, that many of these charges have turned up again and again in a good deal of postmodern criticism of the Enlightenment. And I'm not going to dwell on that here, but only to point out the strange irony that I develop at some length elsewhere, that the postmodern rhetoric against the Enlightenment sounds very much like the Catholic reactionaries I talked about at the beginning. The similarities are really quite striking, and in a person like Carl Schmitt, whom, as you know, was the chief legal theorist for the Nazis and an heir to this Catholic reactionary tradition in the 19th century, the recent postmodern left's interest in him, I think, is, you know, telling in this regard as well. Well, you've gleaned by now that my own view is that any movement can enrage both right-wing Catholic reactionaries and the postmodern left must have something going for it. but before I give my two cheers for Enlightenment, let me make one other important point, and that is that despite all the shoddy history and silly causal claims of the various enemies of Enlightenment I've referred to just now, they do in the end have at least one point worth heeding. And that is that the Enlightenment was disruptive. It was challenging. Indeed, it was revolutionary. Professor Jacob has described the Enlightenment as a great cultural upheaval, similar in scale and scope to the Reformation. Jonathan Israel, also a staunch defender of the Enlightenment, or the Radical Enlightenment, has likewise insisted recently on the Enlightenment's revolutionary character. And I think we need to take these claims seriously. For although a great deal of recent scholarship has insisted on the Enlightenment's moderation in many of its guises, on its compatibility with religion, on its political conservatism even, and somebody like Gertrude Himmelfarb has gone so far in a recent and not very, in my view, successful book, The Roads to Modernity, to argue that not only was the Enlightenment compatible with John Wesley's Mormonism, Methodism in the 18th century, but that a modern Methodist, and I'm not making this up, George W. Bush, is the shining modern example of the best of the British and American Enlightenment. My apologies to our British colleagues. The problem with this type of interpretation, and there are problems. There's, of course, a good deal of very good work that emphasizes the moderate character on the Enlightenment. But the problem, I would argue, with much of it is that it causes us to forget just how radical were, and indeed are, many of the values and mindset standing behind Enlightenment. The disposition to live without fear in what might well be a fatherless world. The disposition to chart our own course and our own ends for ourselves. The disposition to subject even our most cherished assumptions to constant criticism and investigation, to take nothing on faith. And those are challenging injunctions. And the package of values that grew out of their sustained application in the 17th and 18th centuries, the adoption of mathematical and historical reason as the sole criterion of truth, the rejection of supernatural agency, magic, disembodied spirits, divine providence of any kind, a defense of the equality of all humanity, including racial and sexual equality, the belief in a secular universalism and ethics based on equity, justice, and charity, the vindication of freedom of expression, the adoption of democratic republicanism as the most legitimate form of political organization, personal liberty of lifestyle and sexual and other matters, and comprehensive toleration and freedom of thought based on independent critical thinking, that this package of values, like the disposition that underlies them, is threatening, unsettling, difficult, frightening to those who've not yet emerged from their own imposed or self-imposed immaturity. And this is something that we need to keep very much in mind, I would argue, as we look at the world today. For the fact remains, as Jonathan Israel insists, that the universal revolution in ideas, education, culture, social theory, and political reality postulated by the radical thinkers of the Enlightenment was nowhere ever fully carried through and remains today incomplete, not least in the United States, whatever Professor Himmelfarb might say. And so I would be inclined to argue that the Enlightenment doesn't need an upgrade, that we should work rather to fully implement the one we've got. And at the same time that we should remind ourselves and be reminded, particularly when we look at parts of the world today that are only just beginning this process, that it's not going to be easy. It's going to be messy, in fact, that it's going to be difficult, that it's going to be, as my friend Mark Lilla has argued in his recent book, The Stillborn God, which Rebecca reviewed so sharply in The Times, that in many respects, Enlightenment and the process of Enlightenment, with all the uncertainties and open-endedness and messiness that it entails, is in many ways not our default position as human beings. We have to work for it, work continually, and work hard. And on that note, let me just end by citing a passage to you from one of my teachers, Peter Gay, whose two-volume National Book Award-winning The Enlightenment Interpretation is usually today sort of trotted out as an example of you know, the kind of old high intellectual history that we should avoid. It's considered as something as a relic. And yet, I think most people would still agree that it's a wise and humane book in many respects. And let me just quote to you from Professor Gay's last lines. The world has not turned out the way the philosophes wished and half expected that it would. Old fanaticisms have been more intractable, irrational forces more inventive than the philosophes were ready to conjecture in their darkest moments. Problems of race, of class, of nationalism, of boredom and despair in the midst of plenty have emerged almost in defiance of the philosophes' philosophy. We have known horrors that the men of the Enlightenment did not see in their worst nightmares. Yet, though few are inclined to believe it, none of this impairs the permanent value of the Enlightenment's humane and libertarian vision, or the permanent value of its critical method, any more than the philosophers' failure to live up to their own prescriptions or realize their own ideals compromises the worth of those same prescriptions and ideals. It remains as true today as it was in the 18th century. The world needs more light than it has, not less. And the cure for the shortcomings of enlightened thought lies not in obscurantism, but in further enlightenment. Thank you.
And so thanks very much. That was wonderful. What I thought we would do is get through two or three talks first and then have a little question and answer session at that point. That was wonderfully demonstrated that one of the reasons that that we're talking about the Enlightenment at all is that we planned this to be an ongoing project to foster and promote the use of reason in formulating social policy. So it seemed to be a good idea to have at least get some historical grounding in this, but you could see how the history is right there in the present. Before I introduce Peg Jacob, there is a wonderful book called Humanity by Jonathan Glover, Moral History of the 20th Century. And he mentions in there that wonderful vision that Quine often used to quote as well from Otto von Neurath about science being like a boat, and doing science is like trying to keep the boat afloat while you're replacing it plank by plank and staying afloat. One of the things that comes up in my reading about Enlightenment is that there's this enormous confusion about what boat. I mean, people did not feel like they were in the same boat. And I would like to, that's one of the things I hope will come out of here, because I'd like to actually end up with, on the end of day two, and with some agenda, some thoughts about where we should go from here.